Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, emotion worker, and tennis hobbyist. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we all struggle with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hello, Brian. I wouldn't have gone tennis hobbyist. That's a great one. I think we need to add that because I am, as you know, a tennis freak. It's my mental health outlet every single week. Thank you, Paul Fiala, for providing me that space to engage in my tennis experiences. But I also think for today's show that it'd be really important to add in their proud mother-in-law. I love my son-in-law. He's actually the inspiration for today's show, or he helped to inspire today's show. And I knew I would love being a mother-in-law because I love men in general. As you know, I have very close relationships with my brother and my dad and my husband and my friend Brian, who produces my show. I mean, I think I'm one of those, you know, gals that likes hanging out with guys. But I've loved having a son-in-law because he is a son-in-law that really wants to push me to be better, which I like. I like that challenge because he's always thinking about things and he cuts out articles or not cuts out. That would be what my husband does because we're old and old fashioned. Then my husband spends every Sunday reading through the New York Times and he cuts articles out for me. You can see them here on the table in front of me.
Yep.
So it's so cute. And he puts them on my desk for me to read. So he's my screener.
Right.
My son-in-law, being of the modern century,
right,
reads things online and then sends me the link.
Yeah.
And then I print them out so I can read them. But anyway, today's show is inspired by an article that my son-in-law Brian sent me about men and about kind of the changing world of men. Or I don't know. About the article is called Teaching Men to Be Emotionally Honest. And it talked a lot about kind of this crisis we have in culture, but it's not a new crisis. I think it's just been an accepted norm for so long that we never thought of it as a crisis. But this crisis of how we force men, all men, young men, to stifle their natural emotions in such a way that it creates, you know, illness, physical illness. You know, traditionally men have always had higher rates of stress and heart attacks and kind of the stress-related ailments that go along with repressing emotions and feelings. We've always kind of accepted that. Side note, interesting though, is that since post-feminist movement, where women have moved out into the workforce and adopted a lot of those masculine traits of having to, you know, support a family and work hundreds of hours a week, the heart disease in women has grown. I think it's almost equal to that of men.
Interesting.
That's an interesting little side note. But this article, you know, was making links between this lack of, you know, ability to be emotionally vulnerable in young men and how it expresses itself in our culture. And that one of the big shifts is that as women have gained more opportunities, men have declined in a lot of ways. They've lost, you know, ground economically, but they've also lost ground emotionally, because where men could at one point hold their own because they kind of had the power economically, they're kind of losing that in a lot of ways. And the end of the article was a little startling, because the connection they made was, you know, part of this power shift where men are feeling like they're losing some of the power that they had in society is being seen in the violence we see on college campuses, and violence towards women off college campuses, and then mass shootings. This article didn't cite it, but another one I read talked about a connection between Adam Lanza, who's the young man
Isla Vista shooting?
No.
Oh, he was, sorry, that was,
I think he was in Newtown.
Yeah, that was the Newtown shooter.
But even the Isla Vista shootings was also mentioned, because the young man who did the shootings in Isla, or the shootings in Isla Vista, had written like a 100-page manifesto about his frustration with women and, right, not being taken seriously. And so there is this kind of ongoing concern that there's a connection between these outbreaks of anger in young men, as we see kind of what was traditionally where men held power in culture being not taken away, but they're losing that power. So the thing that was interesting about getting the article yesterday, one, as you know, I usually try to think about my show well ahead of time, and mm-hmm. I didn't have something bubbling up, and then Brian sent me this article, my son-in-law Brian, and I went into my folder, and I have a year and a half worth of articles about the men's movement and, you know, what's happening with boys in the classroom and what's happened in marriages as many women are becoming the primary breadwinners in families, specifically since 2008 and the big crash in the economy at that time. You know, 2/3 of the jobs that were lost in the crash in 2008 were lost by middle range manager men.
Mm-hmm.
If I said that correctly, two-thirds of the jobs were lost by mid-level employed men. And prior to that, manufacturing jobs that were primarily held by men, traditionally majority men, had already started on a fast, fast decline as we've seen our manufacturing move overseas or offshore. And as these jobs have come back, what we've seen is that the majority of the jobs that have come back have been jobs traditionally filled by women. You know, mid-level office jobs or manager of offices or kind of like those female sector jobs have come back. So many more men have found it more challenging to find work. And we look at places outside of California, more traditional middle of the country parts of the world where men, you know, there's a very strong code of masculinity. That's been a real challenge for many men because not only did they feel that cultural pressure to be the breadwinners in their families and a source of pride and a sense of identity, but in a lot of the more conservative religious communities, you know, the ministers or the reverends would actually, you know, part of their sermons every week were about the men being the head of the household and, right, the breadwinner, and kind of everyone would defer to him. And so what's happened in a lot of these smaller, more conservative parts of the country, we've seen religious leaders have to kind of shift their sermons to make room for the shift in family dynamics. So I was going through all these articles. So clearly I've wanted to do this show for a long time to talk about men and masculinity and kind of this new men's movement as it's emerging, because it's not the first time that we've had a men's movement or a time where men were starting to speak out about men's rights. And we'll talk about that. It's not the first time we've been there. But the thing that's different this time that I'm noticing from a lot of the articles I've read, from, you know, teaching at the university, from spending time with all my guys, is that it's a quiet movement,
mm-hmm.
right? It's not a taking to the streets, burning athletic supporters, you know, or chanting, holding up signs. It's interesting, but it's very indicative of men in general, how they've been socialized or in our culture to not put their feelings or emotions out there, right? That it's all kind of held and subdued. Men get to have, you know, just a couple of emotions, anger and rage.
Mm-hmm.
Would you agree with that?
Yeah. Maybe something in between, too.
Something in between. Like maybe there's joy and ecstasy, but there, even in, you know, the joy and ecstasy, there can be some anger
right.
involved in that. And it's funny because I remember when I was getting my master's, coming home and telling my husband, maybe it was when I was doing my bachelor's degree in communications, it's my then boyfriend, now husband, saying to him, you know, it's so sad, men really only are allowed to experience two levels of emotion, anger and rage, and everything else, you know, has to be put on the back burner. And he just laughed at me at the time. But it continues to kind of be this subtle pressure in culture that young boys, young men, men in general, are not really free to express their emotions publicly. So it would make sense that this shift we've seen in men kind of embracing their full feeling experience, being more involved in the raising of their children, looking for more equality in their relationships, you know, wanting to not spend 80 hours a week at work and being able to be more involved in home, that these things have all kind of happened quietly and over, you know, on the side, that it hasn't been a big in your face, we're going to do this, we demand our rights, we're going to make it happen. And so I find that fascinating, that through the time, through my lifetime, you know, being raised by my father, who was different than most dads traditionally then. He came to every one of our sporting events and coached teams. And, you know, he was very present in our lives all of my life, which was a different than I think a lot of people experienced in the 60s and 70s. And then my husband, who was way ahead of his time, you know, he did a lot of the caregiving with the girls. He learned to braid hair because he was taking, you know, the girls to school. He was a campfire leader, which if you know anything about campfire, but that's a women's primary organization. And he was a campfire leader and taught the girls to sew and went on every field trip and, you know, taught. So my father, my husband was way ahead of the curve of the men's movement, but just was subtly doing this, as were all of his friends in the 80s. So it wasn't different for us because all of his group of friends that he'd grown up with were the same way with their children. And it's funny because his close group of friends were all of his guy friends all had daughters. So they all were raising girls and in that kind of that same way, super involved. And so then now I see my son-in-law who, you know, is father of my granddaughter. And he's very involved and very hands-on and, you know, wanting to alter his work-life balance so he can be more present in, you know, the raising of his daughter. And so this is, I've seen this happen in my world, but I'm also very aware that this is not the norm still in the rest of the country, that we see more the change for the entitled few, right, who economically can afford to enjoy a more broad experience as a man. But we don't see it as being a truth really across the board all over the country. So in preparation of the show, I did a very small research survey, besides reading through all of my information again. But I also sent out a text and email to all the men in my life with a bunch of questions about, you know, how they view masculinity, how they defined it. Do they change the way they're expressing themselves, you know, in certain company or because they're men and they don't want to be seen as weak? Do they parent differently than their fathers did? And so it was really fun getting the information back from all of the guys in my life today. And I'm going to share some of that as we go through the show today. And I'm going to also be asking you, Brian, so I hope you've got your male thinking cap on today.
I always do.
You brought your full male.
Right.
And so if you're just tuning in, I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. We do meet every Tuesday to talk about those things in our lives that we're challenged by or we find joy in or we just experience as being part of the human race. And you can be part of this conversation at 805-781-3875. I'll open the phone lines in a few minutes. I'm really excited to hear or interested to hear from all the listeners, you know, your feelings about this. And there's a couple of things I want you to think about as we talk through the information. One, can there be a men's movement that doesn't diminish women? Because part of the struggle with this idea of the men's movement or about a men's movement is that in previous attempts, it ends up becoming a battle, you know, an anti-woman crusade or in some way, or an anti-feminist crusade, or, you know, women feel very threatened by or angered by this idea that men would in any way feel like they somehow, you know, have not experienced equality in society. So can we have a real men's movement that doesn't diminish women? Do we have to sacrifice one gender's success for the others? Because a lot of what we've seen happen is a rise of women in culture has resulted in kind of this decline in men. But what makes us a challenging conversation is because women would still say, but we don't earn the same amount of money. We still are subject to violence, domestic violence and violence on college campuses and across the world and, you know, epidemic levels. Mm-hmm. So how can we, you know, even think about men needing more consideration or more rights when we still have women struggling? So do we have to sacrifice one gender for the other one to succeed? And can we have a conversation about masculinity and men's rights or the men's movement without bashing feminists or feminism? Can we even have that conversation? Because what I found interesting is in a lot of the articles that I read, there always seemed to be the counterpoint as to, you know, the anger of women or the pushback of women or feminists or that things that women had fought for and gained. For example, you know, primarily in divorce cases, custody goes to the women, 2/3 of the time, if not more. And so for a lot of men, you know, this felt like a slight, because why were we just assuming that women were always going to be the better caregivers of their children? And one of the big unintended consequences of the divorce spike in the late 70s post-feminist movement was that so many divorced fathers were just kind of pushed out of their children's lives. One, we didn't realize culturally the impact we were going to have on children by diminishing the importance of the role of their father. But there was really no consideration for men wanting to be involved in their children's lives. So that's kind of what's on my mind today, and I look forward to hearing from you. Can there be a men's movement that doesn't diminish women? Do we treat masculinity as a disease? Because quite often when we talk about masculinity, even men will talk about it in hushed tones, as if that natural, you know, masculine energy that both men and women have. We know we all carry feminine energy and masculine energy, men and women. We just kind of have a dominant type of energy in our being. Mm-hmm. But why is it that we treat masculinity as a disease, that's something that we need to eradicate? So can we have a men's movement that actually helps men create a full spectrum of experiences, of feelings, that includes embracing their masculinity as well as enjoying a more nurturing, caring side of themselves? Do you think that's all possible? 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of this conversation with a reluctant therapist. You can also participate on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, our website, thereluctanttherapist.com. Our show is podcasted, so you can go to iTunes and type in A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, and you can get all of our shows. We'll go right to your device. You can also find previous shows at kcbx.org. And we love you to participate in any way you can. You can also send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. So, all right, Brian, you've been sitting there for a few minutes thinking about all of this.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like it's necessary to have a men's movement?
I hadn't even thought about it till you brought it up today, and I don't necessarily see it as necessary. The phones are ringing, so I'm
answer them. Yeah, you answer the phones.
I don't have a good thought, so now I have an excuse to get off real quick.
Okay, you answer the phones, but it's something to think about. So let me talk a little bit. Let's do a little history, right? Let's do a little backtracking on history. Again, as I said before, this isn't the first time we've seen this kind of awakening of men in culture wanting to be heard, wanting to have equal, you know, opportunities to nurture and be a part of their children's lives. And is this conversation about being able to experience the full spectrum of emotions, right? From that sense of being masculine and strong and, you know, the traditional ways that we look at manhood, and to also incorporate other ways. You know, this isn't the first time we've had this conversation. So we're going to go back and talk a little bit about the 1970s and the men's movement in response to the feminist movement. But first, let's hear from one of our men. Jack, you're on the air. What's on your mind? I inspired you in some way.
Yes, you did. And I've called in once before. I work with veterans.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember me, I work out of Washington, D.C. for a former senator.
Absolutely.
I think what we need to do is look at who the role models are for these guys. I work with a lot of veterans, Vietnam veterans, and now the Iraqi vets coming back. And a very good movie played in the film fest here called Birthday. And it's a short, and I've been showing it to various groups. And it's very, very emotional movie about a triple amputee coming back for more. But if you look at the role models that the current generation of men had, it's the baby boomers' children. I don't know what you call the generation, entitlement generation.
We have the millennials. We have the Gen Xers.
Yeah, that's right. I see mostly the young guys that are in their early 20s at Family Works gym in Morro Bay. This is not a plug for them, but a lot of guys bring their girlfriends, or their wives, and they work out together, and it's a wonderful situation. And I see them relating so well. It's just almost like they're brother and sister. Whoever their role models were did an outstanding job, I think.
And I agree. And, you know, it's Jack, because I mentioned that a little bit, that there's been this subtle shift in the last couple generations with my husband's generation and part of my dad's generation, too, of being more involved in modeling kind of more egalitarian relationships or equal relationships, that it was happening subtly behind the scenes and not necessarily like in front of everyone. But here's a side thing that I'm just going to throw out there, because I was going to bring it up later in the show, but you kind of mentioned it. That what we see in a lot of modern relationships, in the millennial marriages in particular, which are really doing a good job of coming together with much more equality in the relationships. There's not, you know, hierarchy of who makes the most money. A lot of them are both working. They're both raising children together. But what we have seen is that it is almost like roommate marriages. That what that what the millennials aren't experiencing is a little bit of that old-fashioned masculine-feminine interplay, which brings that sexual edge, which I talked a little bit about last week. So that was going to be something further in the hour. I was going to say, so do we have to, you know, give up that friction between men and women to have equality in relationships?
I think it's happening, actually.
But I wonder if the millennials are, I don't know if the word is bemoan or realize that they have traded out a bit of the sexual chemistry in their marriages to have more of the brother, sister, roommate-esque equality. Like, I don't know if that's the best trade-off, or if we have to have it, or if maybe that's just the way we have to go now before we find another balance.
I don't think we'll know until their kids grow up and we see what they picked up from their role models.
Exactly, what they passed along. And Jack, thank you for taking the time to call and reminding me also that part of the movement back in the 70s was inspired by the lack of care for veterans that were coming back after Vietnam. And, you know, here the women were, you know, marching and making marching on Washington and trying to make gains for feminist rights or women's rights. And here we had, you know, the veterans coming back with very poor health care and very poor conditions and not being supported. And so one of the early spokesmen for the men's movement in the 70s was Warren Farrell. And he said, you know, men have suffered almost equally as women in gender roles. They've hurt men also, because they not only these gender roles force men to shoulder financial burdens by supporting their families and stifling their emotions, but also it's left men unable to really seek help when they need it after, returning from war or giving of themselves. 805-781-3875 is a number to be part of our conversation today. Jose, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hey, how's it going?
Pretty darn good.
Yeah, you know, that the original question of whether or not there should be a best fit, well, I always go back and forth, because as a millennial, I'm younger, I'm 21, I have very, what people would call, feminist ideals, but at the same time, there's a lot of times where I go back and forth on the role I should play in a relationship. I go out on a date, and I'm expected to pay, or something, you know, very basic like that, or I'm not, you know, and it's based on the woman's perspective on how I should act in adjusting to the new millennium. And I agree with a lot of those things. And so a lot of times, I think a lot of my generation kind of bounces back and forth on whether or not it should exist, simply because we have the option, because there are some who say, yeah, we should do everything feminist, or we should be somewhere in the middle, or no, fight for our old, you know, masculine rights. And, you know, so I find a lot of people my age just kind of bouncing back and forth because we have the option. And I don't know if that's, like, slowing progress or maybe just how progress goes. But in general, I find myself pretty excited because things are changing, if anything.
So, Jose, can I ask you a question? Since I have a 21-year-old on the air. So in the article that I mentioned at the top of the show, one of the people they interviewed talked about a bro code, which exists in kind of the middle-class white male society in this country. And this bro code of behavior involves online porn, binge drinking, hookups, and diminished respect for women, and massive time spent playing video games.
Okay.
Does that sound like your experience as a 21-year-old in our culture?
You know, I would say it's not entirely my experience. I've met people that have that exact experience. But I'm from the West Coast, like beach West Coast, so extremely liberal people. So, you know, as much as some of those things are a part of some of the people's culture I've met, there's also a new definition of that culture and what that means. For instance, pornography. There's a lot of new studies now that say that that actually helps perspectives of women or viewers. But there is extreme degrading forms which reinforce the negative view. So it's not, you know, as I was saying before, everything's just less black and white than it was before. So, you know, video game pornography watching drinker and another video game pornography watching drinker, they have two completely different ideas on feminism and how they treat women and et cetera, you know. So it's kind of, that's why I said these are kind of back and forth. I mean, you have one perspective and the other, and they live entirely similar lifestyles. I don't think it's just yes or no.
I agree. And that's why I wanted to ask you, because I think, you know, for all the gains that we see kind of for this idea of men being able to express themselves, the millennials have much more, you know, equality in their relationships. But there is still a lot of confusion that you expressed. You know, we still have the fallout from the 70s feminist movement, where the 80s were a disaster for young men because they were so unsure of how to date any longer, or what was the norm, or what were the rules for dating. There was a book that was written that's way before your time. It was written in 1982 called Real Men Don't Eat Quiche. And then Brian doesn't even recognize it, but I know my husband does. But this book kind of arose out of those fears and confusion that men in the 80s were feeling about how to behave in relationships with women post-feminism. And so I'm hearing from you at 21 that here we are, how many years later, 35, 40 years later, that there's still kind of an uncertainty about how men and women are to, you know, behave with each other, or how they're supposed to get along. So I think that that's also part of, you know, kind of how, one, it's an example of how long movements actually can take, how long it actually takes for society to truly shift. But that we really haven't made as many gains as we think in our relationships between men and women, that there still seems to be battle lines drawn in a lot of ways, although in the more entitled parts of our culture, we see millennials getting along better. Any final thoughts, Jose?
Yeah, you know, I beat you hit the nail on the head, and it is really interesting, and, you know, it's something to keep thinking about, and I think the more we keep thinking about it, the farther along we'll progress to hitting some of those more important markers in our society that say we are equal, even if we, you know, are never such.
Absolutely. Thank you for taking the time to call. Drive safe. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. The number to be part of our conversation is 805-781-3875. Today's show was sparked by an article that my son-in-law sent me about the emotional lives of men, and it inspired me to go a little further and talk about what I see as this silent men's movement that's been kind of emerging over the last 20, 30 years of, you know, this new way for men to fully express their emotions, to be part of their family's lives, to have more of a definition of masculinity other than just, you know, anger and rage and having to carry the burden for family chores, that there's a wider range of opportunities, but at the same time happening simultaneously with this emergence of the new male, the metrosexual or feeling male, we have epidemic levels of suicide rates in young men and middle-aged men committing suicide. You know, the role of violence on campus, this idea of the bro code in middle-class white males and their utilization of porn and binge drinking and hookups and video games. It's like we almost feel divided in two wide chasm between these two ways of behaving as men. And I understand that, you know, there's a wide range of behaviors in all beings, but if we're having a men's movement one direction, why are we also seeing such movement the other direction towards more misogyny and more violence towards women or confusion? I'm curious to know, Paul, what's on your mind?
Hi. Thanks for introducing this topic. I'm involved with a men's group called the Mankind Project.
I'm familiar with you.
Yeah, yeah. And so we're involved with dealing with exactly the kind of things you're talking about, and providing models and ways of working together and becoming more ourselves and our true power. And that with a kind of a paradigm shift away from an older kind of warrior that deals in the kind of emotions that you're talking about, pretty outmoded. I mean, we're here in California on the West Coast, a little more enlightened than some of the other places, but still I think that it's pretty regressive to think that men are still so much that way, that as we get more empowered, as we tune into our true, we deal in archetypes and energies, kind of primeval, early kinds of fundamental aspects of the male psyche, like the king and the warrior, that there's a new paradigm of that warrior that doesn't have to be just involved with, like, you know, anger and killing, and there doesn't have to be the sort of shadowy dark side of the king, which is dealing with all those kinds of emotions as well, which causes tyranny and other forms of abuse, really. So I think there are, as you say, there is a kind of a men's movement, and there's a lot of history around that, but there are people doing good work around that, and I encourage people to look up MKP or the Mankind Project, as far as really getting in touch with ourselves is where it really starts, about what's really important, and that's common to all humans, whether we're men or women. And then as you develop the powerful, strong, healthy masculine, that only helps empower women too, because we want strong partners. And so it helps it in no way. There's no kind of conflict in terms of feminist movements or, you know, the women's movement. It just empowers us all to be more fully our true selves and our highest selves. And so I don't know. Those are some thoughts on you know, what's going on in terms of my on the ground stuff with the men's movement.
Thank you, Paul. And if people want to get in for men, or anyone wants to find out more, the Mankind Project, I assume, is available. I found you online, so I assume other people can get in touch online.
Yeah, there's a lot of groups in the Slo County that you can get involved with. And, yeah, it's really tuning into some really deep and powerful, common kinds of heritage that we all come from, and the healthy sides of that.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you for taking the time to call. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. You're listening to Public Radio KCBX. We'll be back to take your calls.
It's raining men!
I really just wanted to play that little part of the song. We didn't need to stop right now.
It was worth it.
It was. I just looked forward to it all day. The minute I thought about the show, I said, oh, Brian, download this song. We just have to throw it in there. But we do invite you to be part of the conversation, 805-781-3875. You know, as I mentioned earlier, I reached out to all the men in my family and sent them a bunch of questions this morning, and then asked them, please respond as soon as you can. I mean, and it was interesting too, because I, you know, sent it out to my father, my brother, my son-in-law, you know, different generations of men and different experiences, and asking about what it's like for them to be men in our culture. And I want to read you what my dad wrote back, and I hope it's okay with him. I hope it's okay, Dad. But it was beautifully written and short. My father never ceases to surprise me or amaze me, because one of the questions was about partnerships and these new relationships, and, you know, can we have equality in relationships that really work. And so my father's response was, I feel this is a discussion between partners in a relationship, each one stepping up as the need arises. There is no cookie cutter role model or perception of the perfect union between partners. Economics and demographics influence what is expected by each member. Social media has also influenced most of the expectations in partnerships, which seems to leave lots of folks disappointed. And that, my dad wrote that, Brian. And that's, you know, I love that insight at 78 to be able to look back and say, you know, in our relationships, we have to build partnerships that work with both people's temperaments, right? Their strengths. I think about my husband and my relationship and, you know, how the masculine and feminine dances in our relationship. I really love that my husband is a rocket scientist. I love what he does for a living. So there, I'm kind of gender specific in how I see our relationship. I like that about him. It's one of the things that keeps our relationship kind of fresh and exciting. And I think what we've seen for a lot of young men and young women today is kind of this this such a broad definition of relationship, or, you know, so many opportunities to create your relationship the way you want it to be. And yet we lack really strong role models for how to be successful in any of those relationships that we're creating. And I think that's a struggle. 805-781-3875 to be part of this conversation. And Pat, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing, Elizabeth?
I'm doing good. I know this. I know this, Pat.
You know this, Pat.
So
I was the one who didn't respond very well to your text this morning.
All right. So what inspired you then to call? What came up for you?
Well, because I've been listening to your show, and it's the first time I've been able to really sit down and listen to your whole show. And I tried to respond quickly to the text right before you went on the air. And so this is the thought I have.
Okay.
So you know that, you know, I did a lot of things similar to your husband. I did not teach my kids how to sew. But I volunteered in Girl Scouts. I drove them to school. I made their lunches. I coached them in soccer. And I always told them, you know, to be strong women, you don't need a boyfriend to be a strong woman. And as you know, I have three very strong women in my life now, my wife and my two daughters. And so here's my quandary. Mm-hmm. You once asked me, why do you want to go backpacking with just guys? Why don't you want the women to go?
Because I've been trying to get invited on this trip for 30 years.
I know. Well, here's the deal. So, you know, I love the part of the nurturing that I've done to the extent I'm capable with my daughters. But, you know, I'm still a dude at heart. And so one of the things that I have in my family is you're sort of on guard all the time. Mm. Am I going to be too blunt? Am I going to be, you know, too much to the point? Because, you know, as you know, I my wife is a very strong woman and very successful, and I'm sponging off her. It's good. But, you know, it's you know, so that's the piece of the puzzle. It's like, okay, I'm kind of still on guard. Am I going to say the wrong thing? You know, I can say things to guys that I can't say to women still, even though, you know, in my mind, women, you know, are completely equal at this point. And, you know, and in terms of the workplace, I mean, we're working on getting equal pay, of course. But, you know, so that's the quandary I have. And the question I guess I have is it a men's movement, or is it like what your dad was saying? I think it takes both, you know, it takes both people to try to wade through this quandary of changing roles.
I agree, and I do. And thanks for calling, because I appreciate you participating in my show, Patrick. I really do. But I think what kind of keeps rising up for me here is, you know, how do we take these two movements, the feminist movement, right, of the 70s, trying to help women, you know, have equal pay and equal opportunities and equal status in culture and be safe in culture to express themselves, you know, sexually and physically the way they want to. I mean, for all the reasons the feminist movement was so important, we also need to have find our way back to relationship. Because what I see, part of my concern, what I see is that we have a feminist movement that, you know, still has work to do. We have had, you know, men's movements in different varieties over the years. And we haven't had a couples movement. That where we still struggle is how do we take both of these energies, masculine and feminine energies, and bring them together in relationship that's successful, that nurtures the needs of both men and women. And one of the things that's really interesting is that, you know, men's primary emotional support comes in their intimate relationships. And so the change in relationships, the change in marriages over the last 30 plus years, this kind of movement towards more equality, kind of this uncertainty of who asks who on a date, who pays, who asks who to get married, you know, how do we divide up the chores in the household, how do we divide up the finances in the household? I mean, all of kind of those business-esque pieces of the relationship that we've been talking about. But what we haven't really addressed is how do we come together in a union as a partnership, you know, where we both feel like we're being supported, where we can, both can bring our full emotional selves and both get what we need. And so ironically, you know, Pat's, I totally understand the guys need it on a backpacking trip thing. I've come to accept it over the years, that to be able to relax and let down your hair and just say whatever, and we need to have space for that. But also in our own homes, as women, you know, we tend to have greater emotional support systems through our friends and our families and other people that we're very intimate with and the things that concern us. But for men, that support mostly comes through their intimate relationships in their marriages. And so for a lot of men, the emotional stifling, I think, and this rise that we've seen in suicide rates among men, this rise in rates of depression that we've seen in men, and by the way, you know, women are diagnosed with depression at higher rates than men across the board. But that's because women have a vocabulary for talking about their emotions, and men aren't really taught a vocabulary to address their emotions or to even notice their emotions or to, you know, be free to experience those emotions. But when men experience depression, it comes out kind of in anger, in outbursts. It's not as much about kind of the dark retreating pieces, but when it is, men will tend to binge watch sports, kind of retreat into this obsession with sports. And I can already feel some of, you know, the guys that I know cringing at that idea that every time they watch sports now I think they're depressed. It's not. But my point is, you know, as relationships have become, or for many people, as relationships become more tenuous, a little more difficult to navigate, men have lost a lot of their outlet for their emotional lives. And I think we see that coming out in young men. I don't know. What do you think about that? 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of the conversation. I'm also curious, you know, can we have a masculine movement or a men's movement that doesn't become another war against women? Or, you know, can men talk about their feelings or talk about the ways they feel like they're not supported without women feeling like, you know, what are you talking about? You've been in charge for thousands of years, 10,000 years, and now you want us to feel sorry for you. That how do we bring these two movements together so it supports everyone who's involved in that? So I want to touch a little bit on, you know, kind of the history, because this, as I said, this isn't the first time we've had a men's movement. In the 1970s, there was someone who turned out to be kind of a controversial figure, but his name's Warren Farrell. And in 1974, he wrote a book called The Liberated Man. And he talked about, you know, how gender roles, specific gender roles, not only hurt women, but they also hurt men by limiting, you know, their ability to feel emotionally free. But he really leaned a lot on that our gender stereotypes, the gender roles, kind of force men into this place of being the breadwinners, carrying the pressure of the family on their shoulders, and that has taken its toll on men. And then, you know, Farrell went on to write he wrote quite a few books that became kind of the cornerstone of the men's movement in the mid 80s and early 90s, where men were starting to feel like they were losing ground, not just financially, but also in their rights in caring for their children and in their ability to, you know, get a fair shake in the courts of law. And what I always find interesting is that part of that early men's movement and then the resurgence of the men's movement in the 90s and early 2000s, a lot of what they were fighting for was equal funding for domestic violence care for men and not just for women, that there is quite a bit of body of research that supported that men were also victims or are victims of domestic violence, not at the same rate as women, but are, and they don't get the same opportunities for care or treatment that women do. So here we are, you know, in 2016. And I was reading through the responses of my husband and my son-in-law. And it's interesting because my husband's responses were much more kind of one-word answers. You know, do you feel like you're restricted in your emotional life? No. You know, do you feel like you parent more like your father? No, differently. And then my son-in-law wrote very long, kind of thoughtful responses. And what I thought was interesting was my son-in-law's example of masculinity was being accountable and responsible and not relying on others to help me take care of my family. That kind of a traditional definition of it. He said, it doesn't mean that I don't seek guidance or help from neighbors or my father-in-law, but regardless of whether or not these people help me, I ultimately am the one who's responsible for the outcome. So do you agree with that, Brian?
Yeah, that's probably what I was thinking, but not able to put into words as well as he did.
That's because my son-in-law is very articulate.
Yeah.
And then I thought it was interesting because one of my other friends who's my age, his response to the definition of masculinity, he lifted from Wikipedia, but he liked it. He said, masculinity is a set of attributes, behaviors, and roles generally associated with boys and men. Masculinity is socially constructed but made up of both socially defined and biologically created factors. So is my son-in-law's drive towards kind of being the caregiver of his family a biological response, or is this kind of a socially created response that he feels this responsibility being handed down on him from society to kind of take that on? But he wears it well. The other thing he said that was interesting, and it kind of goes along with what Pat said, was that his expression of his masculinity or his manhood changes in different social situations depending on the friend groups. So he kind of puts on different masks or different responses. But he said in when it comes to family, though, with his wife or with his close friends or hopefully us, that he feels he can be emotionally honest with these people all the time and they see his true colors all the time. So is that more than a take of the modern man, that you have different masks that you put on, that you can move comfortably from emotion to kind of dude bro code to father nurturer? I mean, what I'm hearing is then this kind of opening of opportunities to be a fully engaged and expressive male.
Well, for me personally, I used to be the way where different masks for different people. And as I get older, it's just easier to just wear my emotions on the sleeve and be myself around everybody, because it's just too much work to try and separate the way you act around everybody else and how you deal with your emotions depending on who's in the room or not.
All right, so I'm going to ask you what I asked Jose, because you're a younger man. You know, again, we have this dance between the masculine and the feminine, mm-hmm. men and women, gender roles. How do we behave? You know, how do we get to be fully our authentic selves, as Paul was talking about? You know, how can we be more than just a warrior or a nurturer, right? The caregiver or the soldier. How can we be more? And so what we see in the positive of the new young relationships, again, is this equality and caregiving and sharing. And again, it's unique to the more educated, more privileged of those in our culture. We don't see that shift as much in the middle part of the country. They're still very traditional in their roles. But let's say, you know, all revolutions kind of start from college campuses and educated masses and kind of trickle down. So one of the fallouts, though, of the new relationships of the millennials is that the more equal they are, the less sexual they are, the less there is that kind of grist for passion. I'm not really sure how to say it politely, mm-hmm. but that there's something missing, that these relationships become a little more like roommate relationships. Or, you know, I read an article a couple weeks ago that said the new marriage, the millennial marriage, is about partnerships to raise children and not as much about soulmates or passion. I'll let you think about that.
All right.
Bruce, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Yes, I graduated high school in 1980. So I was right in the middle of what you were talking about, and I had never heard anyone describe it like you. Like, it was a disaster for men. And it kind of was, because what happened was my friends and I, we all, you know, we didn't want a traditional woman. You know, we wanted an empowered woman. We were attracted to that. We were attracted to strong women. So for us, it was awesome. It was great. But then all of a sudden, you would run into women that wouldn't let you be a man. So we got kind of feminized, you know, so what do? Do we open the door? Do we, you know, all of these things, you know, paying the bill. But with relationships, it was like, you know, we got that, we got the strong woman, and then we didn't know what to do with her.
And she didn't know what to do with you, because I keep thinking, remember Alan Alda and Phil Donahue? Because we're of the same era, right?
Uh-huh.
And Alan Alda, yeah, right, he was the face of the feminist ideal man, but the ha-ha was none of the women wanted to marry Alan Alda. They still wanted, you know, the man.
Oh, well, that's what would happen. So what would happen is we would be, you know, supporting these women, and they would go for the guy that was a jerk. They would go for the macho, dead-end relationship guy, you know, the guy in high school, the guy that was always in detention. You know, and it didn't happen with all of them, but it happened with many of them. I have five friends, all in their 50s, never got married, never had kids, male friends.
Do you think it was a direct result of that?
I think so. I think it was they did, you know, because we didn't want a traditional woman. Mm-hmm. You know, and so we'd meet a girl and she'd say, I want to get married, have some kids. You know, where we were going to Talking Heads concerts, we were going to B-52s concerts. We were, you know, we were doing all this stuff that all these enlightened people were doing, you know. And all of a sudden, this girl would say, I want to get married and have some kids. And we would go, God, how boring is she?
Right.
And, right, you know.
It's like we rejected both definitions or gender roles of masculine and feminine, right? Men no longer wanted women to be the traditional stay-at-home mom, and women no longer wanted men to be kind of the masculine lords of the house, and so no one was happy. Because what's funny, Bruce, I wish we'd grown up in the same town, because my five closest friends from college, my roommates, I'm the only one who got married and had kids. The rest of them are still single to this day, and none of them had children.
Yeah, no, it's sad. And then my wife and I, when, you know, my wife has a college degree, you know, she's what you would call an empowered woman. And you know, we had run into some issues in our marriage in our 30s. And basically, she had to let me be a man.
But what did that mean, though? Because it didn't mean you were going to, you know, go around the house slamming things to the floor. Like, what was it? Because my guess is it's kind of the sexual tension of being the man. Or was it different? Am I projecting?
No, it was that. It was the sexual tension of being a man. It was letting me say what I need to say. Letting me be macho without challenging me for being macho.
So getting to own a bit of the primal man as...
Well, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, for how many years? Thousands, millions of years? We've been this way. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly we're saying, okay, don't be this way. And so there's a very fine line, you know? I mean, you know, I don't go in and want to be in her book club. I don't want to go and be in her knitting circle. You know, I mean, so she had to allow me to do the things I needed to do. Mm-hmm. And still raise the kids and still be a caring father and still make lunches for them. But I had to be allowed to be a man. And we're messy sometimes. We're not always neat. We're you know, emotionally, we're messy too.
Well,
but allow me to make my mistakes without, you know, saying, oh, there's, you know. The other thing they did is in television, in the 80s and 90s, the man became the doof. He became the guy that always screwed up and had to go back to the wife and apologize because he was wrong.
That's a great point. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. Because my husband cringes when we watch Modern Family because he sees Phil Dunphy as being kind of the doof in that family. And that makes him cringe also. It's like, why is the dad always look like the dork?
Yeah, it was like Tim Allen in that Tool Time show. He was always, you know, being macho and then having to come back and apologize to his wife. And so, you know, allow me to make my mistakes. and allow me to be a man, you know, because that's what she wants. You know, if she wanted someone feminine, she would be a lesbian. If she wanted, you know, if she wanted a woman, she would be with a woman, you know, but she wants a man. So if she wants a man, she's got to deal with the good and the bad of it. And I have to take ownership of the fact that I'm a man, and I have to assert myself sometimes. I would always feel like a jerk when I got to the point where we would get pushed to that point in our marriage where I would get mad and say, knock it off, you know, and I would put my foot down. I would feel guilty afterwards, and I had to get to a point where I didn't feel guilty anymore about it.
So I have two quick questions to wrap up since I have you, Bruce. Do you have adult children now?
Yes, yes.
Are they
29, 21, and 26.
Anyone married?
Not yet. We're all doing college, so not yet. Got a couple girlfriends on the burner that haven't, you know, nothing's happened, so...
So it'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to see how it sounds like you have sons, how they follow either your lead or not when they get into relationships. Or it'd be an interesting conversation, I think, to have with them is how did being raised in your household influence their willingness to get into relationships? You know, are they preventing, are they, you know, avoiding getting into relationships because of that still uncertain world that we live in? And the other thing, you know, when we look at relationships, husband and wives relationships, and how we do that dance, that I think what you bring up, Bruce, is, again, we still are dealing with the fallout of the 70s feminist movement, the shift in culture, trying to find our way, trying to, you know, find ways to be together without having to sacrifice who we are naturally, that we can embrace part of our masculinity and still make lunches for the kids, and we can enjoy our femininity and still be respected in the workplace. And until we have that, right, until women can really embrace their femininity and be respected in the workplace, it's going to be difficult for women to drop that kind of edge, that demand to be respected and not want to be seen as too feminine. And for a lot of men, I think, you know, to be able to experience their emotions fully, they're going to have to be in trusting, safe relationships with women where they feel nurtured. Because as I started to say, or I did say, you know, is that for most men, their most intimate relationships, their emotional relationships are with their intimate partners. And so if men are in marriages where they don't feel safe to fully express themselves, it can be very challenging to have a fully engaged or fully imagined male experience. So thank you for taking the time to call. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, and I'm so glad we went down this road. I think it's a conversation we could do a couple weeks worth, because it'd be interesting to talk about the mythopoetic movement that Robert Bly started in response to the male movement, or the men's liberation movement of the 70s, where there's a lot of, you know, Real Men Don't Eat Quiche and Phil Donahue, the touchy-feely talk show host, and Alan Alda. You know, there was a very much like the softer, more nurturing male. And Robert Bly, in response to this, you know, kind of talked about men needing to own their masculinity in healthier ways, and to not feel like masculinity is a disease that needed to be cured. And so we always kind of see the rise and falls, because after, you know, the Robert Bly movement, we see another rise of feminism kind of backing men down, calling them the aggressors, and Robert Bly was dismissed as being just a, you know, warrior soul. So I think that this dance between men and women is going to continue on until we can find a way to create unions and relationships that are supportive of the full spectrum of being men and women, but also still have that passion, still have that sexual thrill involved in it. Because I think where we are right now is a little bit of a safety zone in roommate-esque marriages, and we're going to see another change. And I hope we'll be around to talk about those changes next week and weeks to follow. Thank you for being part of the conversation. You can join us on our Facebook page. You can listen to shows at kcbx.org. You can podcast at iTunes, Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, or send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. We'll go out today with a little inspirational music from the movie Footloose. Thank you for being part of this conversation.